You're listening to Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Screen Heroes. My name is Ray, and my two co-hosts and I were just having a really great conversation about dogs and... You know, maybe we'll do a dog podcast next.
Our favorite dogs in film.
Dogcast.
Really enjoyable. Yeah. I think we should talk more about dogs.
I'm fine with it. We'll talk about dogs.
Speaking of my two co-hosts, they are both here with me tonight. Ryan.
Hello.
And Derek.
Hello.
How are you, handsome man?
I'm all right.
Derek is in recovery over a little medical issue from earlier
just
today.
Just a migraine. So. I get
well, you're not supposed to specify, because then people are like, a medical issue?
How I don't know. It's just
like, I get ocular migraines from time to time, and I got one today, and I got over it just in time to do the show. So I'm maybe a little strained, but I'll be all right.
We also realize that nobody's going to watch this live tonight because
there's other stuff.
There's
going
some
on.
Other there's things some happening in the world.
Important stuff. Yeah. So if you don't join us, then we completely understand. If you do, you know, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. We appreciate it. As always, we love you. We all got out and did our civic duty. I hope you did too. It's part of the, you know, citizenship deal. That's what you get to do, got to do. Anyway, moving on. So.
Nice work, Rachel.
You know, guys.
Seamless transition.
I'm only like a 4. Like, let's face it.
Wow. All right.
Weekend box office. Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie that we are here to talk about tonight, killed it. Like, took number 1. Nutcracker and the Four Realms took number 2. But
that's out.
There was a huge difference between the two films, like pretty big. And the new Tiffany Haddish film, apparently she's in every film this year. She has one release every month. Nobody's Fool took 3rd. So decent box office for the first week in November. Still not a huge weekend, but Bohemian Rhapsody killed it.
Yeah, $50 million over the weekend, which is great. And yeah. You know, I mean, when you're comparing, so you have one movie that is about one of the greatest bands of all time and one of the greatest vocalists of all time going up against a weird, dark, gritty version of the Nutcracker that probably nobody asked for, but a lot of us will end up seeing anyway.
You say us, does that mean you guys are going to go see it?
Ray and I are probably going to go see it.
It's one of my favorite fairy tales, and I honestly have been wanting Disney to adapt it for a long time. My hope had been back in the 90s, they did a hand-drawn animation. I thought it would lend itself more to that. You could be more magical with it, and they were having really great songs. They had already done a Tchaikovsky ballet before in Sleeping Beauty. So that just didn't happen. Weird, gritty, wasteland live adaptation with Keira Knightley talking like she has some sort of nasal issue. And so that's what we're getting. And I'm going to see it because I'm a sucker for punishment.
You're going to see it for the same price as you would not see it. So
yeah
might right. As well. Yeah, exactly. My mom wants to see it. So I think we're going to take her to go see it. So
yeah. A lot of news. Not going to get to all the news. Going to skip over some stuff. Mainly, I'm going to skip over the Daredevil's viewership down. And that's because I think I want to dedicate a full episode to what's going on with Netflix Marvel. And maybe we could just have a shit-talking episode where we break down the problems in how these studios can screw up the art sometimes. So, you know, gonna skip over that. Ewan McGregor was cast as the Black Mask in The Birds of Prey.
Was that official or was that rumor?
I don't know.
Because I feel like the article I saw said that it was still like a rumor.
I just go off of what the articles you guys send me. So that's what I type. If that's the casting, I'm really happy with it.
I mean, it seemed like it's a pretty good chance based on the article, if I read it correctly.
Right.
But I don't think it's been confirmed yet. But okay. I like the casting. So I like Ewan McGregor. Although I never really pictured him as Black Mask.
Yeah.
But sure. I mean, he could wear a mask just like everybody else. So
he was just Christopher Robin. So now he's going to the other end of the spectrum, I guess. So,
which I'm okay with.
Yeah, I mean, his schedule freed up since they're not doing the Obi-Wan movie now. I'm kidding. That hadn't actually been a thing, but you know,
Shazam Gate.
Yeah. Da-da-da. Yeah.
They're doing reshoots. You know what that means. It's going to be the worst movie ever. The worst. DC's failing. Headline.
Every superhero movie, every major blockbuster has had reshoots. There's a reason why they filmed the Avatar movie is back to back.
Clearly, you don't understand it, Rachel. It's because it's going to be the worst movie ever.
You know what?
I heard Joss Whedon is directing him.
I mean, reshoots, it's a pretty normal thing in film these days, especially because, you know, studios want to be involved and they're not going to waste their time being on set. That would be weird.
Right.
Basically,
I mean, don't worry about it. It's a thing.
It doesn't bother
Hopefully
me
this
in
is
the
them
slightest.
Filming Henry Cavill's cameo.
The only thing that the only DC news that is kind of concerning is, I guess, projections for opening of Aquaman are down, but I guess that's not surprising considering that would be the effect of Justice League, the previous film in the franchise. So,
and also there's a feeling of meh among pretty much everybody that I've talked to about Aquaman coming out. Nobody seems all that excited for it. That's, you know, a casual DC movie fan that I've talked to.
Yeah. I mean, this is nothing against Jason Momoa, because if anything, he's made the character more interesting, but of, like, the founding members of the Justice League, he's probably the one I'm least interested in.
Yeah, you know? I agree.
So
they've reinvented him pretty well from the Arthur Curry I've read to the Arthur Curry we see on screen, which, honestly, the damage that Super Friends did to that character still permeates most people's perception of Aquaman. So if this is what they have to do, go for it. I'm on board. We're going to see the movie. We're actually going to review it just like we are Bohemian Rhapsody. So, you know, we're on board no matter what.
It is completely finished, too. Right. Swan said, it's, you know, done. And so now he just has to keep it away from the studio for the next however long until the movie releases.
Like a month and a half?
Yeah.
It is weird that it's like breaking news when a movie is done.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like this was a secret that was being done in, you know, in hiding and nobody knew the movie was coming down the pipe. Like
10 Cloverfield Lane.
Right. Like, you know, some of these movies just pop up out of nowhere and like, oh, well, that's kind of cool. But like,
but they're never blockbusters.
Of course the movie's done at some point. Yeah. I mean, or it doesn't show up in the theaters, right?
There wasn't enough DC news that week, apparently.
Apparently not, yeah.
So, in unnecessary sequels and reboots, Gladiator's getting a sequel, Ridley Scott's attached, and Shrek is getting a reboot. So, that is unnecessary, and nobody asked for either of these projects.
So, I'm confused. So, these are very different, and I have problems with them because in very different ways. So,
mine's the same. They're unnecessary.
Well, the Shrek one gets weird, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. But refresh my memory: the main two characters in Gladiator both die at the end, right?
Nah,
it's a reboot. So
that's a sequel.
Oh, it's a sequel.
Gladiator.
Oh, I thought you said
sequel.
A reboot.
Well, Shrek.
The reboot.
Gladiator is a sequel, but the two main characters died. So is it a sequel in
Max
the sense that
Decimus Meridius?
Yes.
Yeah.
Doesn't he die?
Yeah, but yeah. I was just wanting to show that I still remember.
Oh, okay. So is this a sequel in the sense that it just takes place after those events with a totally different set of characters? Because I mean,
maybe it's like Assassin's Creed, and like they are going to go into a different gladiator body. And
there you go. I like it.
Still work for the Animus.
Exactly.
It's weird. I mean, if Ridley Scott's attached to it, then there's probably some kind of strong story.
So everybody wants to put Ridley Scott on this pedestal. Ridley Scott's entire catalog is half amazing and half total shit. So, like, I don't know which half this is going to fall on. Gladiator was the amazing one and got the Oscar, but, like, Gods and Kings, Exodus, whatever that was, bad. Alien, good. Alien Covenant, bad. Like, so
he's kind of the Nicolas Cage of directors.
Except that Nicolas Cage does everything amazingly, so I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Even his bad stuff,
bad
we have fun
but he
watching.
Was great in them.
Well, yeah,
he's
but Ridley Scott can't be great in a movie.
Just saying.
All right, so let's talk about the Shrek one for just a moment here. So Illumination,
the internet's talked enough about
it's DreamWorks,
right? But the guy who runs Illumination is going to be heading up.
He's buying it, or is Illumination
that's
doing
part,
it?
I think they are part of DreamWorks.
I didn't know that.
But anyway, it's not really a reboot. They want to tell more stories in the Shrek universe with the exact same cast. They just don't want to be tied to what's already happened. Which sounds to me more like just lazy movie pitching than anything else. But they want Mike Myers and Eddie Murphy and Antonio Banderas. They want the same voice actors to play the same characters, but they don't want to be tied to the events of the previous films.
All right.
So I don't know. How do you reboot with the same people? Is that still a reboot?
I honestly don't really know what to say. So,
so that one's weird. Like, I don't understand what to call that. But, you know, I don't know. I think it's strange.
It is strange. I'm not entirely sure what happened. Did Illumination buy the property from DreamWorks? Because DreamWorks has other things going on right now. They're kind of done with that.
I didn't read close enough into it to see those specifics. When I read that they want to keep the same voice cast, that's where I was like really just confused at that point.
Well, I mean, it's not like they don't have the time. Because what's Mike Myers doing? What is Cameron Diaz doing?
Bohemian Rhapsody.
What is Eddie Murphy doing?
Dr. Evil political
Yeah, that
skits.
Was pretty funny.
I didn't get a chance to watch it.
Let's see. Next, Andrew Lincoln had his last episode in The Walking Dead, and literally 20 seconds later, they announced that he will be leading 3 made-for-TV movies.
Which is kind of a huge spoiler for people that hadn't seen the episode yet, so yep. That was really nice. Thank you, AMC, for that. I guess they could have been prequel. No, they couldn't have been prequel because he was sitting in a coma.
So yeah.
Until the zombie apocalypse.
These are made for TV movies?
Yeah, they're going to air on AMC.
Okay, so they're not going into theaters. Okay.
Right.
That's weird.
Yeah, that was unfortunate for me to see that. I don't watch it live on Sunday night because I don't have AMC, so I have to wait until the next day.
Not a lot of people do.
And less than 24 hours later, and it was spoiled to me through many channels.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. So,
a ton of people reported it. Clickbaity headlines everywhere.
Unavoidable.
Mm-hmm. That is a huge reason why I stopped watching The Walking Dead, because within moments of the episode airing, I would have it spoiled for me.
By people on Facebook, not even clickbaity headlines necessarily.
Yeah,
sometimes it is.
It
but...
started with fans, and then it just ended up being official websites. The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, comic book, movie, like all of them. They do it. So it's very frustrating.
It didn't ruin the episode for me, but it did spoil that part of the episode for me, and that was disheartening. But one thing they didn't talk about with that that episode, it was also Lauren Cohan's last episode, and nobody really made a big deal about that, which is kind of weird for me because she's been in it since season 2. She's next
really
to Andrew Lincoln and Norman Reedus and whoever the lady is that plays Carol. I can't remember her name, but she's been in it the longest, and so that's a pretty big loss for the show too. They just haven't renewed her contract yet. So,
I mean, as an outsider, someone who hasn't watched the show, it does seem really silly that they would hype him leaving the show so much, only to basically undercut that within like an hour.
Yeah.
You know?
I honestly would have sat on that announcement for about a month.
I mean, at least give people a week to watch the episode.
Yeah, it doesn't take that long. I mean, based on the way it happens in the episode, you can tell something is going to happen. And they've all said that they're trying to, the new showrunner has said that she's trying to put together a Walking Dead universe, a WDU, I guess it would be. But, so, you know, this is a good way to do that. And there's some other stuff that has happened in some of the shows. It's a good way to do that. And I'm actually excited about that. The show's kind of gotten back on track this season with the new showrunner, but it's still...
It has waves.
Yeah, they need to just, like, tighten the reins on what people are allowed to say.
That's fair.
And the time frames they're allowed to say it in.
Yeah. Then I guess the last piece of news I'm going to talk about today, the remake of The Time Machine. This one is actually kind of interesting because Leonardo DiCaprio is attached to star. And the director, Machete, of It is attached to direct at this point. So I didn't throw it in with the unnecessary thing earlier because we just watched this film about a month ago.
The original,
Months ago, something like that. So it got a 2005 remake, or
2004, 2005, something like
somewhere
that.
Somewhere around there. That's not really... it was underwhelming, but still very beautiful, and a lot of people liked it, a lot of people did not. So I think it's a good story and could use an update. It would be really fun to see. I think it'd be fun to see the time machine now, like in modern times and not set in 18th century or 19th century London. That's just me, though.
Yeah, I mean, so for people who watch our Phil R. Hull's review of the 1960 time machine, it's one of my favorite stories, favorite sci-fi movies. I would like to see a new version of it that sticks close to the novella. You know, the original sticks pretty close to it, but doesn't really go all the way with that, and the early 2000s remake throws most of it out of the window. Not all of it. You know, the Morlocks are there. The time machine still is relatively the same object. But I would like to see something that's really close to the novella. Leo's an amazing actor, so, you know, that's a good start. You know,
right.
It certainly, he doesn't attach himself to bad movies that I can recall. Mm-hmm. You know, which is good. So I'm pleasantly surprised that it's happening with him, and I'm looking forward to hearing more.
Sounds good. Okay.
I do want to say episode 4 of Titans came out this last week and introduced the Doom Patrol, which is another show that's going to be on DC Universe, so they were kind of testing the waters with it, and it was very pleasant. I enjoyed the introduction to the Doom Patrol, and if you're not watching Titans because you don't have the DC streaming service, then you should definitely torrent it because it's really good. We don't condone that, but we do condone people watching good superhero shows, and I think that's Absolutely. What it is.
By so, legal means.
By whatever means necessary.
By legal means, Ryan.
Yeah. So please watch it by whatever means, Pirate Bay or DCU Streaming Service, any of those, message me and I can give you the address.
No. DC Universe that's Streaming right, that. Service. Is yes. where you can watch Titans.
Yes, there's no Pirate Bays there, so don't go to anything like that and search Titans. Season 1, Episode 4, Doom Patrol.
So you're just recommending they skip the first 3 episodes?
No, you should definitely check out the first 3 episodes, too. Because
you're confusing me now. I mean,
but, you know, your story Robot Man and Negative Man and whatever other mans there are in the Doom Patrol are pretty cool.
Robin so. Man. And...
It's not enough women.
Not enough women. There is one woman, she's pretty cool.
Yeah,
like 50s good. Era, like, pinup. In of modern course. Day, but she has kind of a twist to her that's kind of cool. But anyway.
A literal twist, like, no.
Yeah, potentially. If you're familiar with the comics, maybe you'll figure it out.
Interesting.
All right, so that is going to do it for news. We're going to take a very, very short break. What? I have fun with it. I get dirty looks from Derek, like, every time I talk about this silly commercial that we do, and... It's not fair. Like, you want me to lead the show, I'm leading the show. We're gonna take a short break. We'll be right back.
Do you like Star Trek? Because over at Red Shirts and Runabouts, part of the Heroes Podcast Network, we absolutely love Star Trek. Join us every week with me, one of your regular hosts, Gregory Bosco, as we talk about your favorite characters, your favorite movies, your favorite episodes. We even respond to some of your comments on Twitter and Facebook, at least those that are appropriate for us to talk about online. Every Friday, Red Shirts and Runabouts. See you next week.
We're back, everyone. Did you miss us?
Probably
no.
not.
No, okay. That's fine. So, we are here to talk about a movie that debuted this weekend, that released, I should say. Debut is such weird terms with movies. We're here to talk about Bohemian Rhapsody.
I'm kind of confused as to what's happening with Rachel tonight.
Are you okay?
I'm a little drunk.
Oh,
okay.
I'm not, guys. I'm really not. Yeah, we're here to talk about Bohemian Rhapsody, the biopic for Freddie Mercury, and starring Rami Malek, quite a few other people.
Yeah. him on a soundstage.
I have the cast list here. First and foremost, what did you guys think of the film overall? Just good vibes, bad vibes? Did you enjoy it? Did you not?
Well, I think first we should talk about how it's been received on some of the big sites.
No, I think that's important. And so from a spoiler perspective, you know, I mean, it is a biopic, so a lot of you probably know a decent amount about
biopic,
you know, Freddie Mercury and Queen anyway, but here is your spoiler warning if that's something.
If you don't know anything about his life.
If then... that concerns you. So this is your spoiler warning. So yeah, so Ryan, how was it received?
It was not received well by critics. Audience and critics have much different opinions on this movie. It's, I think last time I looked at Rotten Tomatoes, it was 55%.
60. It's at 60
okay, it's
now.
Gone up now.
60 for critics, 94 for audiences.
Yeah.
The split's not as severe as Venom, but it is a pretty significant split.
On a movie like this, it's a very significant split, I feel like, because you're talking like superhero movies, sure, like BVS had a big split, but on something like this, you know, I think it's more relevant.
It's the critic reception is disappointing, because I like to think that the three of us are critics at times, but we try to be moviegoers first, fans first, critics second, and, you know, we've all agreed and said multiple times that no movie is a perfect movie. There's always something you can nitpick, but if the nitpicking takes away from your enjoyment, what's the point? Like, why are we doing a movie podcast if we hate everything we see?
Sure. IMDb has some stuff all over the place. So it has an 8.4 out of 10 on just the regular IMDb. The Metacritic score, on the other hand, is 49. And that's out of 100.
Crazy.
And just as like a couple examples, The Hollywood Reporter gave it a 70. Empire a 60. Slate Magazine a 50. And The Guardian a 40.
So if you go and read the reviews, which I did, not all the way, but the little Rotten Tomato snippets, a lot of the critics' problems with the movie were liberties taken with the source material. And, you know, it's a little embarrassing to say, but I probably don't know as much about Freddie Mercury as I should, and there were things in the movie that I learned that were surprising to me, but there's also a lot of things that I wouldn't know, and a lot of the things they were complaining about were things I wouldn't know. You know, I wasn't really following Queen or Alive for a lot of their reign over the rock world. But yeah, that seems to be the consensus. And I think critics, for some reason, maybe it's because they're an older crowd, seem to care more about them deviating from the what actually happened in reality and making it a more entertaining story for the masses.
So let me ask you guys this. Even if we know logically that they couldn't put 15 years, because that's what the movie takes place, between 1970 and 1985, the Live Aid, 15 years, and we know they can't shove everything in there, do you think they did a disservice to Queen or Freddie Mercury and or?
Well, it's a complicated question, right? Because it's two-pronged. It's one, can you make a biopic in general, because you are trying to fit some type of lifetime into a two-hour film. And the other is it supposed to be the letter of history? Because it's not a documentary. It's a biopic. Those are two different terms for a reason, right? Because there are documentary films that are 2 hours, and there's documentaries that are multi-part series. This is not a documentary. It was never intended to be.
No, this is a movie for mass consumption at movie theaters. You know, it's not, you don't see a lot of documentaries releasing like nationwide at movie theaters, and there's a reason for that, you know?
And then when you add in the fact that, yeah, it covers 15 years, and I mean, other biopics cover longer time frames and things like that, but 15 years, even if you, I mean, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of things happened, and it is impossible to make a film that could cover everything over a 15-year span. It's just not possible. So if you went into the movie under the belief that somehow this would be A, as historically accurate as possible, and B, a complete account of what happened during that time period, I don't know if you've ever, like, how you're kidding yourself, because that's not what this was supposed to be.
I don't know what the specific things that were left out or churched up or whatever you want to call it for the movie were, so I can't answer to whether what you just said is actually what they're complaining about specifically, but I think you have to take some liberties with something like that when you're releasing a movie to a mass audience. You know, his life may have been a lot more depressing than what the movie was, and nobody's going to go pay money to see that.
Well, it also has to do with he did a lot of things that would be considered adult content, right? And when you're doing a biopic like this, you want to be able to release it to, like you were saying, the mass audiences. Nobody wants to put out an R-rated or an X-rated biopic because AMC is not going to show that. It's not going to make $50 million opening weekend, yeah, right? And they want this to be a story for everybody. So they dive into some of the harsher times of his life, some of the more depressing aspects of his career, but they don't. It's not a full-fledged account of it. And they're not certainly going to show the more sexual, overt sexual and adult content because they don't want a rated R film.
I don't think it's really necessary to tell the story, and you know, we'll get into that more, but I thought that was they handled that in a fairly respectful way.
I agree.
That was not offensive to, I can't imagine anybody really, but anyway, we should probably talk about what we thought of the movie overall.
Absolutely.
Since we've kind of covered the, you know, critics. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I thought I knew a good amount about Freddie Mercury. I learned a lot more in this movie, but I really enjoyed it. I was very impressed. I don't usually watch. This felt like an Oscar bait type movie to me, and I don't usually go to theaters to see that. I think I love Queen.
Yeah.
And this movie also made me realize how many songs they actually made that impacted my childhood. It resonated with me. You know, it was, I thought, a good account and did service to the band, as I know them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how about you, Derek?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too. Queen has always been one of my favorite bands of all time. I grew up on it. And so it was really cool to see, first off, a movie that has all of that music in it that isn't like The Mighty Ducks or something like that. That's a more adult film. And, you know, again, I was not alive during these dates. I was born in 1987, which is 2 years after where this movie stops. And so I don't know the historical accounts, but if I'm going off of the film, it was cool to see some of the inspirations and how some of these songs came to be and how they might have been pitched or created. It was kind of neat. It was cool to see some of that stuff. The story was really interesting. I learned some cool stuff about Freddie. I thought the cast was great. I thought the acting was really good. You know, I'm sure we'll talk about the Live Aid concert at the end of the film, but I thought that was an incredibly impressive film sequence from a technical perspective. What that took to pull off, I think, is very impressive.
She's gonna start crying.
Yeah, they're looking at me because it's my turn. So I have to be completely honest. I was not expecting the emotional weight this movie was going to hold over me. I didn't realize how much Queen had permeated my life. I had no clue. I always thought that Stan Lee was the most influential figure growing up. But now I'm rethinking it. It might be Freddie Mercury. It might be Queen. He meant so much to me, and I had no idea even. I want to sing because of him. I wasn't afraid to tell my family and friends that I was bisexual because of him. He is daring and bold, but still shy and, I guess, gentle all at the same time. And I had no idea just how important this all was until I was sitting there watching it, and I was excited to see it. And then I was overwhelmed by, like, this wave of sadness that, like, I'm never gonna see him perform live. I'm never gonna have the chance to meet this person who was so over the top and kind and just a lot of fun. And I don't know how else to put it except that, like, I just identify with this man and his words so often, And I didn't even realize it. So, movie was intense for me. It really was. The movie hasn't affected me like this in a really long time. It was, for being a biopic that went through the years chronologically, it wasn't formulaic. It was, it was a Freddie Mercury movie, but it also didn't force Queen to be the background to him, which, if you were alive during his lifetime, the media did. It was all about Freddie Mercury. He was always on the cover of things, and people talked about his lifestyle and his sexuality and everything, of course, but kind of forgot the other wonderful members. And this movie didn't do that, which I thought was really great, too. Pacing was great. Cinematography was really good. The wardrobe department did a fantastic job recreating some of these looks. So I was really impressed, and definitely one of my favorite films of the year.
What did you think of the director, Bryan Singer?
So that's my number one issue, is that Bryan Singer ended up getting the director's credit when
he... I was going to say, you're giving a lot of praise to a movie and a director that
I don't like.
Notoriously...
Well, yeah. He was fired from the film, though.
Yeah.
Was he?
Yeah. So he didn't complete the film.
Somebody else took over. I'm looking that information
up right now. A good amount of the film was reshot and redone because of him being
fired. I think I remember some of this controversy.
It has to do with rules in, you know, the guilds and all of that about how to credit somebody appropriately. So you can't just fire somebody in the 11th hour and not credit them for their work. And I don't think this is an example of why that's in place. More of an unfortunate situation.
Yeah.
That's a side effect of something that's meant to protect people and their credit. But yeah, this is not really a Singer film. His name is there. He gets the credit for it. But his vision for the film was different enough that he was fired from the project. You know, and so that's an important thing, I think, for people to know. Did you find the... Because I'm drawing a blank on who replaced him, to be totally honest.
Yeah, I'm still looking.
But yeah, so I mean, you know, there's other examples like that. You know, Whedon taking over Justice League, for example, the way the credits work there is complicated, and Ron Howard taking over Solo gets complicated, right? There's rules about percentage of time, and I don't know the exact letter of those rules, but this was an example of that. So
yeah, I was surprised. I didn't.
Dexter Fletcher was hired to complete the film.
Thank you.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that Bryan Singer... Because all that controversy happened like over a year ago, I'm pretty sure. It's been a while.
The movie was delayed.
This film has been in the works since 2010. And since then, the biggest controversies, it's hot from studio to studio. Sacha Baron Cohen was originally attached to play Freddie Mercury, which I still maintain would have been a good casting. He is a weird guy, but he does his acting really well in the movies that he appears in. That he acts the crap out of it, so I think he would have done it justice. But for the most part, people have wanted to downplay his bisexuality, mainly the gay aspects and the AIDS. And Bryan Singer wanted to do that too, even though he's a gay man. So I don't understand that at all. So, and that's why the three of us were really concerned earlier this year when they had this giant article about it was erasing that or ignoring that. And this film chose not to. I thought it did a really good job of addressing all aspects of his life. Even the fact that, you know, he's a person of color. You may not know that. His real name, his birth name is not Freddie Mercury.
Though that was a cool stage name. Like, not really stage name, that was a cool name that he gave himself. But, yeah, I think a lot of, some of the critic stuff I've read talks about how it glosses over those parts of his life, and I'm not sure that that's fair. I think critics, some of them would have gone into the movie anticipating that because of the drama behind the scenes, and were looking for places where they could say they could have gone deeper here or there. Mm-hmm. But they show his bisexuality. They show relationships that he has with people. They show his drug use. They show the some of the group sex type scenarios that
they don't show the actual
right. But yeah. You know, I mean,
the subtext is there. Like all of us picked up on it.
It's one of those like show don't tell kind of concepts, right? Like you don't actually need to depict a sex scene for you to be able to tell the audience that one is about to happen. Right. TV's been able to pull that off for a long time. So
fade to black.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and so there was a lot of that, and you got to see his isolation and, you know, whether that was the Paul character that was helping to isolate Freddy. I don't know, maybe if that's part of the issue, maybe Paul was not the villain the movie painted him to be. I do not know.
I know that they were saying a lot of the dates were issues. The critics were saying that a lot of the dates were not correct, which seems like a weird thing for them to take liberties with.
And there weren't a lot of dates in the movie.
No.
Every once in a while, a year would pop up in the corner.
Yeah. And then I guess Mike Myers' character was actually like, he's an amalgamation of a lot of different executives from a lot of different record companies.
Sure.
Rather than being multiple people, they just decided to make him one. And so that character never actually existed in real life.
So that actually makes a little bit more sense to me to know that. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because again, you only have 2 hours. So do you want to show six scenes with six different people that are basically the same thing? Well, they
could have added yet another montage, which the movie had quite a few of already.
So many montages.
But a montage of them getting declined or denied or, you know, mm-hmm. shot down by record companies. I feel like that would have probably been just as good. But I do like Mike Myers, so, you know, I was on board with it. I didn't know that going into the movie either. I learned that after when I started reading reviews. So
I had no idea Mike Myers was even in the film till his credit popped up at the very beginning, and Derek and I just shared a look. Like,
it was a weird coincidence too, because if you've seen Wayne's World, there's a pretty prominent scene in that movie featuring a Queen song. So.
Yeah, they have a weird connection, which I love.
So I'm wondering if that's why he was in it, because maybe on a personal level he has a strong connection to Queen and their music, and therefore he wanted to, you know, participate in that.
Well, that movie was responsible for making Bohemian Rhapsody chart again for the third time. So that's pretty cool.
Agreed. I think that making that one character worked well for the narrative that they were trying to show, which was that these guys were incredibly unique. They had an idea for what they wanted to do, and they were going to do it. And it was just a matter of who was going to help them do it. You know,
in the end, if we look at the people from that era, the people that have survived the longest, that had the longest staying power, were the weirdos.
Oh, totally.
Led Zeppelin and Rolling Stones and David Bowie and Elton John and Queen, like, all stand out in my head as giant weirdos who pioneered or did things their own way. And maybe there was studio involvement here and there or whatever, but, you know, Steppenwolf doesn't have that staying power, and Bachman Turner Overdrive doesn't. So, like,
Huey Lewis in the News does.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, but he's that's still, 80s. Still doing... I'm talking about 70s. Oh, okay. Like...
Fine. I see how it is.
Wrong decade.
I just wanted to bring up Huey Lewis in the News.
Sure,
okay.
Sure. No, I think you make a good point. I mean, Queen was incredibly unique, right? That's the whole point, right? You can listen to so many different kinds of tracks from them, and that's what made them so special. Mm-hmm. And that's why I like these scenes, because they're pitching, like, when they pitch Bohemian Rhapsody, right? It's a 6-minute song. That is insane. They're pitching a 6-minute song for the radio that's got an operatic section and all this craziness in it that just never existed in modern popular music before.
You look at popular music now, it is still a weird song when you put it up against the formulaic pop music, even the alternative scene. It's still odd. And that's...
The alternative scene is formulaic now too, so, very, you know, it's...
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's part of the point, though. That's why in 2018... Queen still tours sometimes, you know.
Not with Freddie Mercury.
Obviously not with Freddie Mercury, right? But they've had multiple people step into those shoes because people still want to hear them,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I think is pretty telling about what they were able to accomplish.
Yeah.
And I like that the movie did show that while Freddie may have been the voice and maybe he was a little bit more of a driving factor, if you know, if it's maybe it's not 25% across the board, everybody had a hand in the music. Everybody was pitching song ideas, pitching riff ideas and concepts, and they used everybody's. You know, the scene, and we're kind of jumping around a bit.
I've never heard that song before. I'm going to find that album and listen to it.
It is a B-side.
I want to hear it.
But like the scene later when he comes back and wants their forgiveness and everything like that, part of the deal is from now on, songs are by Queen.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a big deal because that still isn't a normal thing. Some bands do it. I'm not saying nobody does it, right? But it's still abnormal when the credit is given to the band.
Well, look at it. Like, the White Stripes are two people. Or they were. They've since broken up. And all the credit for everything went to Jack White. Like, Meg seriously got nothing. Like, they had her sit there and drum her peppermint drum to the beat. And that was it. It's like, so, you know, it's pretty impressive when an entire group gets a credit, and I liked that little addition. Whether it's truthful or not, I didn't go back and look at dates and credits and stuff.
No, but I do remember Queen stuff saying just songs by Queen. You know, there wasn't a name there, whereas the Beatles put their names. You knew which songs were Paul's versus John's and so forth. I mean, but you knew. And don't get me wrong, for those who are big Beatles fans, you can tell stylistically which song is whose because they're very different styles. But they were credited to the person, not the band.
Right.
Right. And there was a point where Queen didn't do that anymore. And I think that's a big deal. And I like that that was brought up.
I was a little disappointed that David Bowie only got a name drop. And they played Under Pressure and everything, and it was like, that's a huge Bowie song, too, you know, it's...
I was really hoping we were going to see a Bowie cameo.
But we would have heard a casting choice, yeah, like, a long time before the movie ever came out. There's no way they could have hid that.
That's why part of me feels that maybe the original plan was to have Bowie. That, and they didn't, either they didn't find the right person, or they didn't feel right replacing him with somebody else.
Well, if they started this in 2010, like yeah. Rachel said, then they could have planned on actually having Bowie right. in it.
That's what I'm saying. Oh, yeah. Okay. And then when that was no longer possible, there's two possible outcomes there. Either one, they couldn't find anybody they felt was a right fit, or they didn't feel right even trying.
Right.
You know, because I mean, it took 23 years to get a Freddie Mercury film. You know, those were big shoes to fill. Bowie's are no smaller, and it's much more recent.
Right.
So,
it did give me faith, though. Seeing Rami Malek's performance gave me faith that they could possibly do a Bowie biopic, and that not completely turned me off from the idea, because I didn't think that really anybody could perform the way that Freddie Mercury did. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they did really, really well, so,
yeah.
He has one of the most unique voices, and they do explain that it's because of his 4X.
And I had no idea,
which is cool. I didn't know if they were gonna like go to that level of detail, and it's kind of an offhanded remark.
Well, I think it would have been kind of a turnoff for people that aren't as big of Freddie Mercury fans to see this guy with this giant overbite, you know, throughout the whole movie, and not have any idea why he has this giant overbite, and nobody say anything about it. It's all just ignored the whole movie. I think that would have been weirder.
That's fair.
It was a good way to handle the fact that they skipped over his childhood, going back and reading more about Freddie Mercury's early days. Like, he was really bullied for that because they weren't just protruded. They hung out, and he had to grow into it, and he got really used to covering it with his lip as well as his hand when he spoke. And, you know, when they fled from Zanzibar to England, then his life got a little bit better, but he was still kind of an isolated person. So just that one little throwaway line at the very beginning when he's auditioning for Smile was pretty perfect. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it did give him extra range, because he does have a slightly bigger mouth than the normal person. And that's what makes his vocals pretty impossible to replicate. And like something I paid attention to were all the coaches in the credits. There were 7 vocal coaches, 4 guitarists, 2 drummers, and 3 bass coaches. So, you know, these people might have been dubbed later on. I don't know. I didn't check. But
maybe in some places.
They truly, like, got the essence of Queen. I felt like I was listening to Queen. Like, that was the closest I was going to see to a Queen concert, and I thought they did a great job.
Yeah, I think you bring up a point that kind of shows, again, like, the scope of the film. Like, we can call it a Freddie Mercury biopic all we want. There's a reason it's called Bohemian Rhapsody and not Freddie Mercury. Because it's not about Freddie by himself, right? It's about Freddie with the rise and fall of Queen. That's what it's about. And that's why he's more front and center than the rest of the band
is. It's a Queen movie, but it's around the point of view of Freddie Mercury. And so you're getting his story, but a large portion of that is Queen.
It's supposed to be the things that happened in his life that impacted the band. So if something happened that didn't have any impact on the band, they probably left that out of the movie. Yeah. That's not what it's about. Right? Again, not a documentary, right? So showing his childhood would not have really done anything to impact the band.
Right. Or all of his other odd jobs that he kept, not just the airport one.
Exactly. Like, you needed to show that he's got something, right? That wasn't, but what it was wasn't what was important. What was important was that he was seeing these guys play and he wanted to be a part of that. That's what was important. Mm-hmm. Right. So let's see. We're kind of jumping around a little bit on this one.
Yeah, we
are. Well, I mean, I think it's easier to do that when, you know, the story is pretty much out there and everybody kind of knows the story. So we're not really doing anything too crazy. I do think that the way they handled his sexuality was really respectful. I think the people I talked to about the movie were like, well, they didn't really show a bunch of gay sex or anything. I was like, did you expect them to show? Like, yeah. I don't understand why.
They didn't
show
a lot of straight sex either. Yeah,
I mean,
like, what?
Yeah, it was, so that was, I don't know, it was,
I think that's part of the problem. Like, why do you have to show it for us as an audience to understand that it happened?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it was pretty clear to me that it was happening.
I think people were expecting it because of how, I don't know how Freddie Mercury, what he was very flamboyant in the way he acted in his life. And so they just probably expected that that was what his life was just a bunch of that. And so maybe, I mean, he died of a sexually transmitted disease. So, you know, I just think that people assumed that that's the majority of his story when it wasn't necessarily, you know.
And I mean, they did show some of it. They, like, the big parties that he had and, you know, the get-togethers that he would
have. Him grabbing some dude's junk randomly.
The people, like, leaving the very next day, like, doing their walks of shame and things like that. They showed that. And he really only had one relationship with a woman his entire life. And, you know, Mary was a huge part of his life. So there was a big focus on her, which makes sense considering, you know, you go back and read, and even at the end, it was like lifelong friends with Mary.
It's good that you brought up Mary, because I thought that was one of the most emotionally difficult parts of the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, seeing her have to deal with, confront something that she had known about Freddie, and then deal with him not understanding why he can't still keep her around.
Yeah.
And then the scenes with the lamps were very difficult emotionally, you know, seeing him try and signal her with the lamp and then get nothing back, you know, that for somebody who had almost everything going for them in their life and all they wanted was this one thing and they couldn't get that. And it just showed how lonely, you know, it can be at the top. And that was definitely emotional for me. Even I thought it made me sad, you know.
Yeah
I mean, it was that was a really intense situation, right? It explored that, you know, he had to come to terms with his bisexuality as well, and she may have even figured it out before him, you know, from the outside. Those were intense scenes, and I felt like if that's really how their relationship was and she stuck around through all of that, that says a lot about who she is as a person. Yeah. To provide that type of support, you know.
I was really happy that she didn't just stick around and be his, like, spinster friend. She moved on with her life.
And eventually.
Yeah. I mean, it took a lot longer than it probably should have, but I
assumed that he, like, bought her this house right next to his and everything, so she kind of... It feels weird to say she owed him a lot, because nobody owes really anybody anything, but she probably felt like, yeah, she owed him a lot. And so, you know, he picked out ones where he could have his, you know, window, seeing that window and all this other stuff. It's implied. I mean, they don't say that in the movie. It's not, it's just like coincidence that they just happen to have houses next to each other with windows that can see. That obviously was planned, but
Showing his loneliness was a very big part of the second half of the film, and I think they did a good job of that, because all the other band members get married, they have kids,
and he ostracizes them.
He does, because they are moving on to other things, and from a personal perspective, they don't need him like they do in the band. The band, they all need each other for the band. All four of them, it works. Queen works because of the four of them.
Right.
Right? That was the whole point. But on their personal lives, they didn't need him.
And he disrespected that relationship that they had. They show him constantly having a diva attitude and, you know, showing up late and kind of trashing the other's ideas and then going solo behind his their back. So, you know, they show him professionally ostracize these people, not just from a friend. Like, first he does it as a friend, and then he does it as a band member. So
I will say one criticism I have is the going solo part, because they made it such a big deal the first time around when he rejects that and he fires
Reed.
Thank you. But then it feels like all of a sudden it's a complete 180 and he's gone solo, and they didn't really explain that progression very well. Obviously, you know, you can kind of put pieces together yourself and think that Paul manipulated him into that, right? But I feel like that would have been useful to show what was different that time versus the first time.
That's a good point.
That's all. Because the first time, I mean, he was furious about it. Yeah. Just the idea of betraying the band and leaving them behind was like one of the most...
He calls it, do you want me to break up my family?
Yeah, it was like the most offensive thing you could have said to him. And then in what feels like no time, he's done it. And so I would have liked to have some more steps in there.
Yeah.
I think if I had to give another criticism to the movie, the biggest part that I probably had a problem with was the Live Aid concert itself. Specifically the shot where it's like coming down from way up above and like going down over the crowds and up to the stage. I thought that that looked really CGI and not believable at all. I thought the people looked super fake, and to a certain extent, it got better at certain points when it got closer up. They were probably using more realistic models of people, but it was like when you were watching, or when you play a video game and you look out into the stadium and there's like, it's like paper standees of people because they don't want to render the entire person. I mean, it was an impressive shot, don't get me wrong, but I thought the CGI was done very poorly, and in a movie that doesn't have a lot of CGI, it stood out to me as a pretty big negative.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. So when I mentioned the technicalities behind making the concert, I more meant the onstage stuff.
I wasn't saying that in regards to what you said.
But it is an interesting point, though, because, you know, this type of movie, it not being a massive blockbuster, I'm not even sure what kind of budget it had. I was going to look that up real quick to
Go for it.
To see.
The recreation of Live Aid
was impressive.
So $52 million was the budget. So it's obviously
already broke even after its first weekend.
It did, which is great. Obviously, some movies have had smaller budgets. A Quiet Place, for example, in 2018 had a smaller budget. But you know, most movies these days have triple that budget. Just as a perspective there for kind of a fun comparison on Red Shirts and Runabouts, we've been reviewing some Star Trek movies. Star Trek Nemesis in 2002 had a $60 million budget.
Yeah.
16 years ago.
Which is more like a $100 million budget now, probably.
Probably something not like that, you know. So just for some perspective. So, you know, when you have so many people involved because of the music that's required and things like that, maybe they just didn't have the budget to really render that the way they should have. It probably didn't help.
I saw it on IMAX too. I don't know if we didn't discuss that whether it released on IMAX or not. Only on IMAX? Do you guys know?
It was not only on IMAX. Okay.
Because I only had the option to see it in IMAX at the theater I went to.
We saw it in IMAX, but it was not the only option.
So maybe it looked better in standard. It did not look good in IMAX, in my opinion.
And I think that's fair. It doesn't help them any that they were trying to recreate something that took place, you know, at a time where video technology was still pretty limited, and so the references for that aren't great.
Also, the Live Aid concert is very special, and it's important to them as Queen, just for background. The Live Aid concert, when Queen performed, it was considered a turning point for the concert. That whole thing where all of a sudden the donations flooded. It wasn't exactly nobody had donated beforehand, but they really did enliven it. People that were actually there and saw it live still say that Queen was the best part of it.
And that's because they turned up the mixer for them. Oh, we all know that now.
To 11.
I was waiting for that to be like, so be I honestly thing. Well, because I thought, so okay, so here, so here's my where my head was for this. Because Freddie was having voice problems, I wasn't quite sure what that slider did, and I thought maybe they were gonna like splice in his singing so he would be lip syncing.
No.
Or like singing on stage, but the volume would be such that nobody would be able to hear his real voice at that time. No, obviously that's not what happened.
Itchy vocals under
control. Yeah, his voice came back. So in chat real quick, Midnight Pearl was made a comment on what Ryan was saying, like they couldn't do like a drone shot of the crowd. And I think that the limitation there was the sheer size.
They yeah, trying to get 150,000 people yeah. or whatever it was.
I mean, it's the largest concert.
But yeah,
it's still the largest concert of all time.
They had shots of real people. So they
just copy and pasted.
They let people come in and see that.
So I had that thought. There's a shot from the stage when Freddie's playing and they're looking out under the crowd, and I could have sworn that it was a copy and paste of several groups.
Oh, wow.
Because I thought, like,
I didn't see that.
Yeah, now, obviously, I saw this once in IMAX, it moved very quickly. I'd like to watch it again where I could slow all that down, because that's what it felt like in the moment.
I swear to God, if you need to do that, you should do that without me, because I don't want you to ruin it.
I think the Live Aid concert is one of the coolest things I've seen.
They recreated their entire 20-minute set from start to finish. They recreated choreography. That was pretty impressive. Absolutely. Camera shots.
My critiques have to do with the crowd that was watching, which is, if anything, one of the least important parts of the movie, right? So, like, I'm interested in the technical aspects behind recreating it. That's all.
Yeah.
So I'll say that another problem I think this movie had, which is not actually a problem with the movie, but more of the fact that theaters weren't showing it. My normal theater I go to didn't have any showings at all. You could not see it there. I had to go to a theater closer to where you guys live, and in there was maybe one showing or two showings a night, and it was only IMAX. That you guys had to go too. To
a morning show.
Did you go to the one close to you?
No, we had to go to the one about 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah, and so I mean, I think that really they could have made more money.
Yeah,
with that, and then I also had somebody behind me when we were waiting in line that went, well, it's not going to be as good as A Star Is Born. I have AMC Platinum, so I'm going to see them both, but I know it's not going to be as good. And so it's like, okay.
There's a huge difference between the two.
They're not the same movie. Not even close.
Not even close.
It's just, it was, that annoyed me before I even went into the movie, hearing somebody talk like that. Anyway, you were going
to
say
something. According to Box Office Mojo, it was released in 4,000 theaters, which is a normal number for a blockbuster film. Like the Marvel movies are between 39 and 4,100 usually. So that's
weird that I couldn't see it at my theater.
So here's what's interesting about that number. What that number doesn't tell you is show times. It just tells you theaters. So what it means is it released everywhere, but theaters were toning down how often they showed it and in what formats they showed it. Because there wasn't like a Dolby option. For example, Fantastic Beasts has Dolby options, and that's my favorite way to watch a movie, right? So they showed it in IMAX. I don't even know if it was filmed in IMAX. And they showed it in some other regular time slots in some local theaters. So that number doesn't always represent the whole story, right? Because they clearly were not utilizing their screens to their fullest extent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting.
Yeah. It made impressive money, but I feel like it could have been more impressive with,
if they made it a little easier.
More accessible, yeah.
Well, we would have saw it sooner. We had to wait till Sunday morning to see it, and we would have seen it earlier if it was.
We saw it Friday night, but, I mean, we would have probably seen it Thursday night if it had been available at my normal theater, so
yeah,
it's a little disappointing.
Midnight Pearl said 9:45 with all the grandma and grandpa's at.
That's
fun fact.
Literally when we saw it.
The woman next to me was at least 55 plus, and she was just as a hot mess as I was. Like, I could hear her in the two of us were
like, another fun fact, the lady sniffles. Behind me was probably a grandma that was saying, it's not just going to be as good as a Star is Born, but I'm an AMC Platinum member, blah, 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 blah.
Like, part of me wants to go rip that person a new one for even drawing the comparison, just because they're two movies that deal with music, but, like, it's just not even worth it.
I mean, yeah, A Star is Born is the fourth incarnation of this story.
And it might not be, I mean, I never saw A Star is Born, so it's hard for me to say.
A Star is Born is very good, but if you ask me which one of these movies would I want to rewatch
for... You saw A Star is Born? Oh, okay.
I love Queen. Queen is amazing. The music itself makes me want to watch Bohemian Rhapsody again. You know? Like, I just want to listen to the movie again.
And I think it is just as much Oscar bait as A Star is Born. I think Bradley Cooper deserves at least a couple nominations. I mean, he might even deserve Best Director. We are close to the cutoff time for the Oscars, so it could be. But I think Rami Malek,
he's a contender.
He deserves an Oscar nom for that, because, you know, critics can say what they want. He did fabulous, and most of the critics said that he had an outstanding performance.
He'll be nominated. I have no doubt he'll be nominated.
I don't think he'll win.
I don't know who else will be up yet, so I'm going to reserve that, because they have so many of these more Oscar-baity films that don't get wide releases that I'm like, that when they get nominated, I hadn't even heard of them yet.
Yeah.
And we try and know what movies are out.
Well, they mostly release in December. And we'll start seeing them pop up here and there. That's when the biggest Oscar bait is.
Like, yeah.
October's kind of our first taste, and then December's when it really hits.
I mean, it's hard to compare those two films. Yeah, they're both musical, but, you know, one really focuses...
There's a lot of music movies out there. Right. I don't understand why you would even draw that comparison.
I mean, because they were released so close together. Right.
Because you want to seem like a smart movie goer to whoever you're going with. Maybe. That's the only thing.
If A Star is Born was released in April, no one would be talking about it with Bohemian Rhapsody.
That's true.
You know, it's just because
the comparison wouldn't be there.
It was just released. They were very close together.
I will say I'm really impressed with the Bohemian Rhapsody soundtrack. They could have just made it, you know, a Queen's greatest hits. And they didn't. Like, it's very interesting. They put in some of the movie mixes as well as the original songs, so you get some of the fun, more montage-y stuff that they did, and you get things right out of the movie, as well as the entire Live Aid concert all in one track. So if you wanted to listen to a full 20 minutes, you could, which is pretty cool as well. So they did some fun stuff with the soundtrack, and it is one of the soundtracks that I will be buying.
So, let's see.
Letter grade?
Is there anything else you guys want to touch on?
No, I think we've pretty much covered everything I wanted to talk about.
Yeah. I just want to say, so at the end of the movie, you know, they kind of do the what happens after the fact kind of thing. And so I didn't know what the time frame was going into the movie. I didn't want any of that information going into it. So I was a little surprised that they stopped at the Live Aid tour. But I guess after watching the movie, that feels like the organic end to it, right? Because then the rest of it would just kind of be a downer.
Right.
So you want to end on the hopeful note, because again, not a documentary.
He was a very private person. He kept his diagnosis private from most people, but they didn't release any albums after 1990 for a reason. And he did pass in 1991. There's the only album. A couple photos of him during that time where he looked very sickly. So I don't think it would have made it any more powerful of a film to show Rami Malek in emaciated, sick makeup. I think they did a fine job.
I agree. And I never noticed. I never bothered to look. But I thought it was interesting that the only album Queen ever released after, like an actual studio album, not like a concert album, but an actual studio album after Freddie's death only included stuff that Freddie had already recorded.
They never wrote new songs without under him. The name Queen.
Which I thought was really interesting. Because, mm-hmm. You know, other bands have moved on from band members who have either left or things like
or
that.
Or passed or whatever, yeah.
So I thought that was very interesting that they never did that. I assume because they've been touring my entire life with different lead singers, that they had continued to put stuff out with those singers. And because it wasn't Freddie Mercury, I wasn't particularly interested in hearing that. But now this kind of changes my opinion of the, you know, the last, you know, 20-ish years of Queen. So I'm going to do a little more research into all that type of stuff.
Brian May Roger Taylor and their former manager, Jim Beach, were heavily involved in this film. Jim Beach helped write the film as a consultant, and on set, Brian May and Roger Taylor were often there as creative and musical consultants. So, you know, they...
But critics know better about
they, what... They had their blessing.
So the one thing I did hear is this is the movie Queen wants you to see. And I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it, because obviously whoever's making the movie, that's the version they wanted you to see, right? So it's kind of a nonsensical statement to begin with. But I guess the point they're trying to make is Queen wouldn't go out of their way to make themselves look bad. And again, I think that this misses the whole point of the film, right? It's not a documentary, and no one was going out to make a movie that would make anybody look bad. The point was to show a particular point in history for a particular band that was very influential, and I feel like the film does that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how making it grittier or darker does anybody any favors.
Right.
You know, if we...
directed by Zack Snyder.
I mean, seriously, though, right? Like, what's the point? What does that do for anybody? You've got a beloved band who has, you know, that's still out there performing for people music that we all grew up loving.
Like, how entitled do you have to be to say, I want to see my heroes fail? You want to know what happened in his life? Go read all the biographies that have been written about him. Go watch the interviews with his former bandmates and his family. Go read his Wikipedia. You're not entitled to a movie filled with gay porn, apparently, massive drug use, and a man dying. Like, that's, if that's the movie you wanted to see, you're an asshole.
I just don't think it'd be entertaining. Like, you have to... There's storytelling
their
techniques.
Their music is entertaining by itself. Just absolutely. Watching that would have been enough for me, to be honest.
But when you watch the film, you know, it starts on an upward tick. The band becomes more and more successful, and they have their big breaks. And then there's some down notes where Freddie goes through the isolation and the drug use and all that type of stuff. And then it goes back and it ends on a positive note before they do the what happens later thing. And that's part of the movie making and storytelling process, is you keep people interested. You make people happy. They're enjoying themselves. Oh, you make it really real. You show some of the emotional aspects of it. And let's leave on a high note of something they did that was positive. I mean, the Live Aid concert was a big deal. What they did was a positive, good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see any reason not to showcase that.
Agreed.
So, Ryan, any final thoughts on your side?
No, I think we pretty much covered everything that I wanted to talk about. I really enjoyed the movie. Are we giving a letter grade?
Sure.
Not?
I mean, we usually do.
So. I'm going to go A-. I thought it was good. It's not really my type of movie in general, but yeah, there were some other than the technical issues that we had talked about, and the one lady behind me that was annoying. I think the movie was pretty good. So,
I'll go with a full A. I thought it was well done. I didn't notice during those few technical errors. I'll probably notice on a rewatch, and I do intend on rewatching this. There are some emotional. Weighted movies that I won't ever rewatch again, but
it was like Logan for me, where I like the movie but I'm not gonna watch it again personally. Sure. Like, I'll listen to their albums. That's all I need.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, between an A and an A minus as well. I really liked it quite a bit. The technical errors are really just in that sequence towards the end, and it's kind of, you know, side to the rest of the film. But you know, for those who listen to the show know I'm pretty critical of that type of thing in the average movie that we cover on the show anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, somewhere in there.
It was really nice to see a film that differs a lot from what we usually cover. We usually stick to sci-fi, fantasy, and superhero, so it's nice to mix things up every once in a while. And originally it wasn't on the slate. The four of us, Ryan and his significant other, like, we all caught a movie this summer. We saw the trailer for it and we were all like, let's just go see it together or review it or something. Let's do this. All of us looked pumped. We all love the music. So we just were like, let's do this.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's why we did it, guys. Every once in a while we can branch out too.
We can.
We're cinephiles.
And now that we've branched out, next week we're going back to our DCEU,
yes,
which we've been pitching the last few months here.
People are just loving it, eating it up. We're getting so many hits on the old Twitch from
next
it.
Next week is our Justice League.
It is.
As always, I'll give you a brief review of our previous film, which was Shazam. And that was kind of cool because we haven't ever been ahead of a film.
Yeah.
So this time we're going to do Justice League. We're going to be casting some characters as well as bringing in old favorites. So it should be a lot of fun.
So we started with Man of Steel. We did BVS. And then we branched away and did a Justice League Dark film, which led to our Shazam movie.
Mm-hmm.
And now, yeah, so then Justice League. So that's what our DCEU currently looks like.
Yes.
So please join us for that one next week. If you chat with us, then on Twitch, when we do this live Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, you can chat with us and, you know, we
shout
appreciate...
Shout out to Midnight Pearl, who has been talking to us all night.
Absolutely. We appreciate any input and feedback, you know, as long as it's relevant to what we're talking about, you know, that's really great stuff. So, all right. Anything else, guys?
Nope.
I think that's it for us.
I think that's it.
All right. Ryan, where can people find you?
Buster Props.
Ray.
Oh, Siren Ray. I was waiting for where can people find you.
Like, you don't get that.
Line.
You haven't earned that.
What's my motivation?
And I am the Star Trek dude. We are the Screen Heroes Podcast on the Heroes Podcast Network. You can find us on Twitter at Screen Heroes Pod. You can find us at Heroes Podcasts on Facebook, Twitch, and Instagram. We also have a Patreon. If you can check that out, we have an exclusive Slack channel, the Patron Lounge on Slack, where you can...
Toppin'.
It should be, where you can talk to all of the hosts on the Heroes Podcast Network about whatever you would like. It does not have to be show-related.
We'll give nudes for money.
I won't.
Some
not
of us.
Me. You guys.
Choice people will.
You guys will.
And we also, we actually have a storefront now on TeePublic.
Which is kind of cool.
If you go to heroespodcast.com, we have a store link right there. And you can get some HPN branded merch, which is really cool. We've got
like this mug.
Like this mug that I have here if you're watching this on YouTube or Twitch. And there's t-shirts and there's mugs and there's all this cool stuff. We're going to be adding some more things in the next couple of weeks here. So you can keep an eye out for that.
Yep.
Otherwise... We'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, next week. Let's do it.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.